committee. I'm going to change the agenda just a small amount. I'm going to move the work session and the introduction of committee bills to the top here in the order. And so I'll open the work session and would entertain a motion on the draft proposal.
Mr. Chair, I move that we introduce LC 1812, 1813, 2481, 2826, and 2930 as committee bills.
Representative Beyer moves that we introduce 1812, 1813, 2481, 2826, and 2930 as committee bills. Is there any objection?
I missed one of those numbers. No, I'm kidding.
We're all here.
Yeah. Hearing none, so adopted. Thank you. We'll close the work session and open a public hearing. And this morning we have with us Henry Hewitt, the former chair of the Department of Transportation Commission, and Kate Dean. Thank you, folks, for being patient with us this morning.
Thank you, Chair Brown, and members of the committee. As Chair Brown indicated, I'm Henry Hewitt. I'm currently chair of the Sewell Reeves Law Firm in Portland, and as he mentioned, formerly chair of the Oregon Transportation Commission. And I'm here today to report on the work of the I-5 Transportation and Trade Partnership. This is in the nature of a report. It's about the future. I'm not requesting funding. I'm not requesting approval of any specific recommendation, but talking to you today about work that has occurred regarding the I-5 corridor between the Rose Quarter in Portland north through Vancouver up beyond where 205 connects in Washington. It's about economic development, trade, the economy, and livability in that corridor. Before reporting, though, on the future, I wanted to comment, if I could, briefly on the present and acknowledge the most difficult task that you and your colleagues have in dealing with the current economy, the current budget, and the state of affairs with respect to getting that all in balance. And I think it would be remiss if I didn't observe that those issues are about the economy and livability and economic development today. And unless you and your colleagues in the House and the Senate and the governor can unlock the key for healthy schools, I think we can kiss economic development and livability goodbye, at least in the near term. That's certainly true in my community, and I believe it's true in Medford and in Ontario and in all of the corners of the state. So my report today isn't about those issues, but I want to acknowledge the very difficult task that you all have in addressing these issues in a difficult environment where I think we need to figure out the way through it in a way in which we can look back and say we've helped improve the situation that exists in our communities. Enough about the present, now back to the future. The I-5 Transportation Trade Partnership really began with a bi-state committee that was formed in 1999. It was chaired by Portland businessman Vern Riles and made up of business people from the Portland community and the Vancouver community to take a look at the issues in the I-5 corridor related to freight mobility and the economy, and make a determination about whether the current transportation system was suitable for meeting the needs of the future. That committee reviewed technical data and had significant staff input and acknowledged that there was a problem in that corridor and that the current system would not accommodate growth of the economy and if left unaddressed, would create substantial difficulty with respect to congestion, freight movement and the livability of the communities alongside the corridor in both Oregon and Washington. In short, the committee concluded that doing nothing was not an option, and that further study would be needed to determine what kind of solutions would be appropriate to solve the congestion problems that will occur if nothing is done in the corridor. So with that backdrop, in 2001, Governor Kitzhaber and Governor Locke formed a bi-state I-5 partnership to consider the issues of congestion in the corridor and determine whether a consensus could be formed around one or more solutions to address the issues. Finding a consensus in this corridor, everybody understood at the outset, would be difficult. We are dealing with highway issues, we're dealing with interchange issues, we're dealing with freight movement, we're dealing with neighborhoods, we're dealing with environmental issues, we're dealing with a river, we're dealing with heavy rail, we're dealing with public transportation. All of these issues are significant in addressing transportation between the Rose Quarter and up into Washington. What emerged from the appointment by the governors was a 26-person task force. The alternatives considered included a small group, probably of the what I'll call the transportation groupies, who perceive the problem, understand the problem, and probably think that they understand the range of solutions. After consideration and a lot of discussion, ODOT and WSDOT and stakeholders concluded that a small group could not solve these problems in a way that would be supported by the communities that would need to support them if they would ever be implemented. So a 26-person task force was created. I co-chaired it as a former chair of the Oregon Transportation Commission with Ed Barnes, who's a current member of the Washington Transportation Commission. The 26 people represented a wide cross-section of people from both Oregon and Washington. Mayor Katz was a member from Portland, Mayor Pollard from Vancouver, Commissioner Cruz from Multnomah County, Commissioner Pridemore from Clark County. The neighborhood communities along I-5 in North Portland and in Southwest Washington were represented. We had representatives from the environmental community of Southwest Washington and Oregon. And in some respect, in a different way, we had active business people from Vancouver and Portland on the committee. Three business people from Portland, three business people from Clark County, ODOT, WSDOT, the two ports, TriMet, C-Trans, and Metro. If you can visualize this group, we couldn't have had a more diverse set of people beginning a process with more diverse views. We had everything from the build nothing perspective to the more lanes, the better perspective. It was the true aggregation. If you ever saw the movie The Breakfast Club, we couldn't have had people really beginning from different positions. And at the outset, what I think we understood was that there would be no perfect solution from any single perspective. And we began talking about the need to find a solution or set of solutions that would be 80%. So everyone would be giving a little bit from what their perception would be of the perfect solution, but everyone would strive to find a solution that they could support and say that's 80% okay from my perspective. We had lengthy meetings. This wasn't the kind of thing that you often see where substitute members show up. We had virtually complete participation in every meeting. The mayors were active participants. The business community members were active participants, and certainly the neighborhoods were active participants. The meetings occurred monthly over an 18-month period. We also had numerous town meetings of the neighborhoods and community stakeholders, website with all kinds of input from people along the way, and open houses. I think that if there's ever been an example of a process that really was successful in engaging the community in a discussion of a set of complex issues, this may be the prototype for it. We had excellent technical support and leadership from the staffs of ODOT, WashDOT, and Metro. And in the end, we produced a report, which I recommend to your review at least, containing findings of the circumstance in the community and in that corridor, issues around freight mobility, how do we move freight, how do we have livable communities, and the recommendations that were the outgrowth of this 18-month study was supported by 25 out of the 26 task force members. That's not unanimous, but certainly a consensus and a remarkable feat in and of itself, given the diverse views that we began with. So what do we recommend for the future for the I-5 corridor between the Rose Quarter and up north into Washington? That there should be three through lanes, effective lanes, moving goods, people, and freight through that corridor. Today, there are several choke points that are only two lanes, and most significantly, the I-5 bridge, although it does move three lanes, it functions as one and a half. And so the three through lanes concept is that's for through traffic. And at the bridge, we need to accommodate on traffic, off traffic, slowing, trucks, and a whole connection of weaves and moves that make that bridge unacceptable for the solution that's needed in the long term. So in addition to three through lanes, the recommendation is for a new bridge that will accommodate three through lanes in addition to the on and off movements that are needed to get on in Vancouver, get off in Vancouver, get on in Hayden Island, get off in Hayden Island, and move three through lanes through that corridor at the same time. We also recommend light rail on the bridge, and not just to Vancouver. Light rail from the Oregon perspective has always been to Vancouver. And in this group, what we understood is that there are very few people really who are either trying to get to Portland from downtown Vancouver or from Portland to downtown Vancouver. I think that the reality is that that's never been a solution to the transportation issues of Southwest Washington. In order to address their issues, light rail doesn't just go to Vancouver, it goes into Vancouver. So the recommendation is not just to downtown Vancouver, it's to extend light rail eventually up north into Vancouver to the SR 500 corridor, and then east across the center, the backbone of Vancouver, to the I-205 corridor, and eventually to loop back down to the airport light rail. What this does, once it can be achieved, is to really facilitate the movement of people who are moving back and forth in this network from the places where they actually live and work to where they need to get to. So the recommendation is for light rail to and through Vancouver, eventually forming the loop. Thirdly, light rail alone doesn't solve the public transportation needs. There will need to be connector bus services to that spine, and until it can get built, there's a strong recommendation for improved express bus service to serve the commuting traffic through the I-5 corridor from Vancouver. Freight is incredibly important. There's a tremendous number of jobs in the corridor of North Portland, Northeast Portland, Southwest Washington, and the interchanges today are inadequate. So there are recommendations for substantially upgrading the interchanges in the I-5 corridor, North and Northeast Portland Marine Drive, and in Southwest Washington to accommodate a high percentage of the people who are moving to jobs across the river, are moving to jobs along Columbia and in the North and Northeast Portland industrial areas. Rail. There's very little ability to address rail. It's one of those hardest transportation, this is heavy rail, issues that we have because it's the rail corridors are privately owned and operated. We have passenger trains that are a public agency. But this study group came to understand that if we don't find the formula to improving the heavy rail system to accommodate more freight and more passenger transportation, our streets and highways will become so congested that they won't function. So there are recommendations here, and some of them things that can be funded in the short term to facilitate better mobility of freight on rail. This is all connected to the issues in and around the Port of Vancouver and the Port of Portland, where you have multimodal transportation issues of heavy rail, trucks, and ships all coming together in an efficient way to move freight in and out of our region.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yes.
Is this better, or should we wait till the end?
I'm virtually done, so if you want to just hang on, I'll get done. The last few issues have to do with one of the most significant outcomes was, for the first time, a bi-state land use accord. We recognize that we have different systems in Oregon and Washington. We have different cultures, in a sense. But we all now share the reality that in this region, it's one community. And we can't divide it at the river. So what goes on in Vancouver affects Portland, and what goes on in North and Northeast Portland certainly affects Vancouver. So the Land Use Accord is an agreement entered into by the regional governments and the local governments in that region to work together and seek to find a common approach to land use issues. The issue is really, don't improve the corridor for transportation purposes and then see it eroded because inconsistent and different land use principles are applied on both sides of the river. I think what we found in all of this is that Clark County is much more aligned with principles similar to those that we are familiar with in Oregon than we thought. And they care a lot about the same issues that we do. And this land use accord is a recognition that Southwest Washington and the Portland area can work together on not only transportation and growth issues, but also on land use and issues as well. Issues around environmental justice and making sure that improvements and more traffic in this corridor don't unfairly impair the lives of the people who live adjacent to it is a part of the recommendation. And there's much to do. I understand that we have some federal funding to move ahead on an EIS for the bridge area and the bridge. That's good. There's more planning, more study, and funding. But I'm proud to have been associated with this project and hope that when it comes back to you for consideration in one form or another, you'll find it desirable as well. From the state of Oregon perspective, I did want to mention that I think we haven't done all the heavy lifting with this report, although I think it's a perfect beginning point for the corridor between the Fremont Bridge and north into Washington. We haven't addressed the heavy lifting in the area of between the Fremont Bridge and the Markham Bridge. And that's a very complex set of issues, much similar to those that were studied in this. And I think that we can't leave that unattended. So I'm urging on us, the state, the city, and others to recognize that 405 and I-5 also need to be find a long-term solution that's consistent with not only the needs of the community but the economy and the livability of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hewitt. I want to commend you and thank you for the leadership that you've shown and provided this committee in spearheading and bringing this report and the transportation issues in that area that are so important. And also thank that committee for the time that they've so unselfishly given to this.
It was a great experience. You know, we all came there more or less as strangers, and we all left knowing each other pretty well and feeling good about our friendships. And the person who voted no, you know, we love him. He was a good contributor. I want to see your legislature get to 26-1 or whatever.
I'll probably be the one.
For Representative Greenwood.
Thank you very much for coming to report on this obviously affects two states, but it very much affects my district specifically. And I'd really like to ask a couple of questions. One is, Did you deal specifically with the question of getting freight off of that corridor into the Northwest industrial neighborhood? I know that neighborhood association has been very worried about alternative freight routes into the Northwest and such issues as a truck bridge from St. John's and a variety of other things. I wondered whether there was some discussion about this.
There certainly was, and Kate, who really ran the committee and the task force, may be able to address it more specifically. I think that we have in this report having that issue and the possibility of a freight bridge and a connector through Vancouver to I-5 as a future a subject for discussion and consideration. I think what we concluded virtually unanimously is that it didn't solve the I-5 studies, the I-5 needs. So it wasn't an alternative to the recommendations that are in this study, but something that may well be needed in the future as well. So that's mentioned and discussed in here. There are very, very difficult issues through Vancouver for such a freight route. And I think I expect that will come back around in the future as something that will need to be addressed, because we have sort of put a limit now on I-5, and I don't believe it will be exceeded. I think that the future demands will occur, and as they occur, we're going to have to reconsider alternatives through Northwest and maybe growing 205 and figuring ways for freight and cars around the core.
Follow up.
Another question.
Mm-hmm.
High-speed light rail is, medium-speed light rail is very important. We got a 70-mile-an-hour average train between Portland and Seattle. We save a lot of problems, and that's particularly important. But it seems to take like 35 minutes for a passenger train to get from the Portland Depot to the Vancouver Depot, something like that. Was there any discussion on how to make that a little easier?
Yes, and there are specific recommendations in here for fixing and improving the rail system, not only for passenger rail but for freight rail in this corridor. It's largely the age of the system, the inadequacy of the crossings, and ultimately the bridge. So the only true specific rail, heavy rail recommendations are designed to improve the ability to get passenger trains and freight trains in and out of Portland efficiently.
Kate Dean from the Oregon Department of Transportation. Henry is right. A lot of the problems in terms of getting the speed up from Portland to Vancouver are really problems both for freight and for passenger rail, and the report recommendations do include ideas, projects that will improve things for both passenger and freight rail. With regard to the rail bridge, it's kind of an open question. It's in terms of whether we really need a new rail bridge for either passenger or freight rail. If you think about rail cars or a railroad, cars, they're usually very, very long. And part of the problem that we saw was that it's not necessarily the river crossing that's a problem, but the approaches to the river crossing and the fact that we have some at-grade kinds of crossings and needing more siding, crossing of the Columbia River. So we did take a look at the rail issues, and there are recommendations in here for that.
I think the task force and people who are involved in transportation understand well the incredibly significant role that rail should play in this situation. The interesting thing to me, after 8 years as chair of the Transportation Commission and 2 years plus on this project, is that there's no federal funding at all for improvement of rail in this corridor. There's no state money for rail, and so we're stuck with trying to figure out how to cajole rail improvements a dollar at a time. And although we've had some modest specific authorizations in the past, it really is something you have to get funded one off. Now, I'm hopeful, and I don't know that, what the current environment is, that the nation will come to understand that you can't just set rail aside and say it's not part of the solution. It is part of the solution, but we've been woefully unattentive, I think, to the rail piece of the transportation system in this region and nationally. It's on an international scale, it's embarrassing.
Let me ask one last wacky question. Was there any consideration given on water transport from Vancouver to downtown Fort?
Representative Greenlee, Kate Dean from the Oregon Department of Transportation. Yes, there was, but we came to a determination that in terms of the amount of people you could actually move in that type of transportation, that would really be a supplement, not a replacement. And it's also something that very likely would be more a private sector responsibility or activity as a complement to I-5 than a true part of the solution, that as much as what we could do on the system itself.
I didn't mention it specifically, but I should, particularly given your constituency. There was a lot of conversation about whether to build four lanes. And a specific conclusion of this report is that we would do three lanes, but not four lanes. And that's what I referred, when I referred to sort of limiting the future. I think this does limit the future. And the reason that it does is that there's no place for four lanes to go. And if we end up with four lanes, we end up with a mess someplace else, probably in downtown Portland. So there is, I think, an acknowledgement that there is a capacity of how much traffic you can really run through the middle of Portland or down the I-5 corridor. And so the outcome and recommendation here is to run three efficient lanes, but don't expand it beyond that. So the future will require us to look in other places. And this is also about, not recognizing that we don't want to dislocate another 100 homes in that quarter either. The homes are important. The people who live there are important. So the solution recommended here, I think, received this broad consensus because it was understood to be a reasonable outcome virtually from every perspective.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Henry, the I-5 bridge then would be a replacement. It wouldn't be an addition to. It wouldn't save the old bridge. It'd replace it.
The specifics on the bridge require further study, but I think we know enough to know that it will be a replacement. This bridge is so old, and the maintenance costs annually or biannually are so large that virtually any study, I believe, will conclude that we ought to replace it with one or two bridges, depending upon how you configure the highway and freight component with light rail. So I believe this bridge will eventually be replaced.
Will the is the 205 bridge, will it accommodate light rail as it is now, or do they have to make improvements and changes?
I've heard yes and no, so I'll leave that one to Kate.
Chair Brown, no, it's not ready for light rail. You may be able to put light rail on the I-205 bridge, but it does mean some trade-offs in terms of shoulder widths and travel lanes and other things. And you, like 99.9% of the people in the Portland-Vancouver area, when you talk to people, they do believe that the bridge was built for light rail. And so I'm just the truth teller here to say that, unfortunately, no, it's a little more complicated than that.
Was there any discussion, Henry, about how we'd go about paying for it?
Yes, there has been. There has been. Well, I thought at the outset that although the numbers are big, you can't get around that the numbers are big, it's feasible. It's feasible with a collection, a combination of federal dollars, which I think we can attract. This is one of those situations where you're able to say, this is a marvelous study. These are great recommendations that connects two states in a cooperative way, in ways in which the federal government should view as significant and want to support. And I think we've already seen signs of that as we've sought funding for the EIS and other things that are needed. I think it will also require a local contribution on both sides of the river, but they aren't those pieces aren't so large that you would just roll your eyes and say we can't do it. I think we will be able to do it. We don't need to do it today. Hopefully the economy will be stronger. It will probably involve, at least in my view, this is Henry Hewitt, private citizen talking. I don't want to taint my colleagues at ODOT, but we will probably end up with tolls again on the bridges for a while. I think people, given what they think they will get and what I think they will get, in fact, in terms of improved accommodation of transportation, will find that acceptable. The tolls are, you know, you do that without stopping these days, so that at least the delay issue is not a factor anymore.
Thank you.
Have I gone too far?
No.
Representative Dingell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hi, Henry. Thanks for coming here today. And I have a couple of questions, and I've been following the study as it's gone along. You've done a good job at doing outreach. And I wanted to ask you about the light rail connection with Washington, and as our interstate line is almost finished and about to come online. A couple of questions I had about that. How realistic do you think it is that Clark County will look at closing that loop, and what, if you could just provide a little more specificity as to what kind of commitments they've made? And then this other question, I'm not sure that you'll be able to address, but as far as the concern I had about the Interstate Max is, are we going to see people from Vancouver driving over, parking, and then, you know, to avoid the congestion, and then just leaving their car and taking Interstate Max in? And I mean, you know, that's not necessarily the worst-case scenario, but I want to make sure we see a commitment about connecting to Clark County.
I believe that the state of thinking in Clark County is progressed a long way from where it was the last time they considered it and voted on it. I think they have seen the success that it brings in terms of not only the communities that it serves, but the improved transportation. I think that they, and we had 13 people from Clark County on this committee that represent all walks of life, have come to recognize that, as I mentioned before, the old notion of just to Vancouver doesn't work for them. But the notion of light rail serving the spine of Clark County across east to west gets them the same sorts of things that have occurred with light rail to Gresham. And they believe that that's good for them. Now, if we voted on it today, I don't know how it would come out, but I think that there's a growing recognition that this is part of the solution. It is good for the community, and they certainly see the benefits of having that through Clark County at some point in the future. I believe that they will support it. I believe their leadership believes they will support it, and that we will see that happen. Commitments, no commitments. But I think a growing awareness that that Clark County and the Interstate Corridor are one. You know, it's not as if you can say they are separate in any way other than by artificial geographic boundaries. Cars coming to Jansen Beach or wherever it is and parking, I believe they'll do that. I think we'll actually have buses moving people from Clark County along that spine where eventually we want to see light rail go, feeding buses into the end of our light rail system for people to get on MAX and come to wherever they need to go. Yes, I think that will happen. I actually think that's good, and it will cause greater relief on the highway from the light rail than it would if it were only draining the Oregon side of the river.
Representative Dingfeld, just in terms of the commitment, I did want to let you know that we're going through and doing endorsements of jurisdictions both in Portland and Vancouver, and we have had endorsements made in Vancouver of the plan, which includes the light rail. It's been a fairly explicit discussion there. And in addition to that, they are asking for federal funds to begin what we call an alternatives analysis to begin looking at that loop. So they are taking steps right now, some, you know, 8 months after the plan is done. They are putting things into place to begin the public discussion over there about alternatives and routes and things like that. So I think that there are good signs. Just wanted to add that.
I just do one.
I think there's another. Excuse me. Another point here is that the highway improvements and the light rail improvements are inseparable.
Mm-hmm.
One won't work without the other, either in terms of how the system will work or in terms of what it will require to have a broad consensus. This report got the support that it did because it has both. And as we think about how to move ahead, it's critically important that these issues be thought about, developed, and built together. Or else we'll run into a lot of the old issues about you're fixing Oregon problem, but you're not fixing our problem. So I think that as you hear this come back to you, it will always be in the same breath with respect to both modes.
Mr. Chair, just one follow-up. I appreciate it, your response, and I have one follow-up question, but I just want to make a comment. In my district, I have I-84 and 205 in my district, and I don't know if you've done some analysis to find out what percentage of people are coming from Washington that are caused. I mean, it's a huge bottleneck, as I'm sure you know, for a good part of the day, and I'd be curious to see if you have any data that shows how many people that are taking that corridor are coming from Clark County or Vancouver. Actually, be more from Clark County because they'd be taking the I-205 bridge and then in. The other is, just FYI, to look at the Sandy Boulevard, because a huge amount of people get off the freeway and drive right through the heart of my district and Sandy Boulevard. It is, and it's a state highway, but part of the OTEA project, it's being handed over to the city for a portion. So I encourage you to look at that if you haven't already as part of the study.
I'll let Kate deal with part of that, but as you know, I get off the freeway so I can go through the neighborhood where I grew up on Sandy Boulevard. So
for the rest of my to deliver paper.
I know those areas well. There's a lot of traffic using the 205 and 84 corridor, as you suggest. The other thing that was surprising to us is how much of the traffic really is not going beyond the Columbia Corridor.
Mm-hmm.
and to the river. There are a lot of jobs in that corridor, and a higher percentage than I would have thought of the commuting traffic back and forth across the bridge is to serve people not going to downtown Portland, but to jobs in north and northeast Portland.
Chair Brown, Representative Dingfelder, two things I would add. Number one, I am also a constituent in your district, so I know these roads well. A couple of things. We'll follow up and get you the data about splits in terms of Oregon and Washington folks. But I did want to mention that one of the benefits that we saw in the study of making improvements on I-5, I-5 really is the desire line. It's where people are wanting to come. And so a side benefit of making improvements on I-5 is that in the future you have 205 not being, you're preserving basically the capacity of 205. And so it does provide some relief for that part of town and for some of the dynamics that you see over there. We will be having growth, so I'm not sure I could say that it will get better. I guess what I'm saying is that by making those improvements, the rate of it growing to be a very bad problem would be much slower slope.
Great. Thank you.
Representative Mabry. Just a curiosity question. I'm not sure you can answer it, but you probably can. You're a lot smarter than I am. As you were talking about replacing the bridge or bridges across I-5, I was thinking, gosh, it would be really good to have traffic not have to stop for water traffic going underneath. And then I thought about the on and off ramps, both needs an elevation of Hayden Island and all that. Do you think it's a possibility to have a bridge that doesn't have to open and close for traffic, or are we still stuck with that dynamic?
Chair Brown, Representative Mabry, it is a possibility, particularly with a replacement bridge. We've looked at it conceptually, to have a bridge that, and here's the dynamics, you need a bridge high enough to have boats go under and low enough. Pearson Air Park is right over in Vancouver, not to catch airplanes. So, you know, you got some dynamics there that you've got to work with, plus, as you mentioned, all the on and off ramps that lead up to that. We do have a design that we think would work and that could be a fixed span bridge with no openings. And so that has a lot of of benefit. And this gives me the opportunity then to just add on to what Henry has said about the replacement bridge. And I just want to, again, in the interest of being open to you guys, that while the replacement bridge has a lot of virtues and it appears that it would be a strong contender in terms of alternatives, we will need to look at other alternatives when we look at the I-5 bridge. So as we're going through that process and you see things that don't look like a replacement bridge, just bear in mind that we do need to look at all alternatives and that we haven't really made a firm decision that it will be a replacement bridge.
That's a federal requirement.
Any other questions?
Thank you for your interest, and it's nice to be here. This is enjoyable for me. I don't get back to Salem as much as I once did, and the committees are all new people. It's great. Only Janet's still here.
Thank you.
Thank you
again.
Thank you.
We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2455. And Janet, you want to give us an explanation?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At your places today are House Bill 2455, a -1 amendment and a -2 amendment, and an Attorney General's opinion from last summer, or in April, I guess, regarding the issue of towing companies being able to sell vehicles without a dealer's vehicle dealer certificate from the Department of Transportation. House Bill 2455, as written, would exempt towing companies and vehicle repair businesses from the requirement to have a vehicle dealer certificate when they sell vehicles acquired through possessory lien process. The -1 amendments require the lien claimants or the dealers or repair businesses to keep records sufficient to establish that their vehicles were acquired through the possessory lien process and make those records available to the Department of Transportation. It also authorizes the department, again, the -1 amendments, to impose civil penalties up to $1,000 for a violation of the provisions of the record-keeping or sale process. The -2 amendments are an emergency clause to take effect on passage. Just wanted to point out that some towers, companies are dealers. Probably most are not. I think you'll hear from some that are and some that are not. And that the Attorney General's opinion brought on this bill because the Attorney General deemed that with the statutes the way they are written, tow companies that sell vehicles would be required to have a dealer certificate, and some, of course, do not now. So that's kind of the background on House Bill 2455.
Thank you, Janet. I'll have asked that Kelly Taylor come up. Could you, Kelly, explain the -1 and 2 amendments to us then?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kelly Taylor, Department of Transportation. The -1 amendments are, when this issue came up, let me just set the stage with a little bit of history, if you don't mind. When this all came up last year and the Attorney General was busy researching the statutes, because the question came up, do the statutes exempt towers, repair companies, mechanics, apartment owners, people who are stuck with cars and are trying to sell them to recoup their loss, are they acting as dealers? Now, I want you to know that past practice forever has interpreted that those actions are not dealers. So, no, they've never been licensed as dealers. If a mechanic shop does work on a car and the person decides not to pay the bill, the only recourse the owner has to try to make some money back on the work they've done is to take possession of it through the lien process and then sell the car. And the same thing happens with towers when they tow abandoned cars or they tow a regular car and the person decides to walk off and not pay the bill. And even apartment owners are stuck with cars from past tenants and things. So forever that we know of, this action has gone on where people have, different businesses have been stuck with cars for a variety of reasons, and first try to sell them through an auction. If that doesn't work, turn around and sell them later on. And we've never considered them dealers. Well, the question came up, well, I'm not sure I read that in the statute. So we asked the AG to look at it and tell us what they read. And what they read was, you know, it's not real clear. It could be read that there isn't a specific exemption for this action, so that would mean that they should be dealers. And when we reported that back to the Interim House Transportation Committee, they kind of went, whoa, that's not been past practice, and we're not sure we want to go down that path. So would you poke at it a little more? Would you have the AG look at it again? And would you put a work group together of the interested parties to see what, if any, recommendations you would bring back to us, since you're kind of hearing we don't really want to go down that path of making them dealers? So we did. We asked the AG to poke at it a little bit more. And we had a work group that contained DMV folks, towers, both new and used car dealer lobbyists, et cetera. And we looked at it. And what it's really come down to is the AG says, basically these entities get one bite at the apple. Those are my words. It's not the AG's words. They get a chance without being a dealer to try to sell it at an auction. And if it doesn't sell at the auction, that foreclosure, that action, means that it becomes theirs. But if they try to sell it after the auction, if it doesn't sell, then when they try to sell it, that's when they need to be a dealer. So they get one bite at the apple to recoup loss, and after that, they'd have to be a dealer. That's where the bottom line is as far as the AG's reading the statutes. What the work group kind of came up with, and I'm not saying that everybody agreed to it, but what we realized is, whether they're dealers or whether they're not is a policy decision that you all need to make. Practice has been that they're not dealers, but you need to think about that, decide if you want practice to continue or if you want them to be dealers. But in any case, records should be maintained so that we have some way of determining whether or not whatever policy you set is being followed. Because right now, they don't have to keep records. Some do, some don't. But if we go up and ask them, if we get a report that somebody's acting improperly and selling cars when they shouldn't be, and we go and we try to investigate that, frankly, they don't have to cooperate. They can just look at us and go, you know, I'm not going to show you any records. So, and I don't have to maintain any records, and you can't do anything about it. So the one thing that the group realized in the interim is that some records should be maintained. And that brings me to the dash ones. We were trying to be clear that if you chose the policy, because that's what we heard during the interim, if you chose the policy to make it clear in the law that acquiring vehicles through this lien process, either at the auction, trying to sell it at the auction, or those cars sold after the auction, acquired through the lien process, those cars, you don't need to be a dealer. Now, if you go out and buy cars somewhere else and put them on your lot, you bet you need to be a dealer. But by keeping records, and you'll see that in the bottom part of that amendment, by keeping records, we'd be able to go up to somebody and say, I want to see the records you've got on these cars you have on your lot. And you better be able to show me that you got them through the lien process and that you're selling them afterwards. And anything you have for sale better be that way. And if you're selling anything that wasn't acquired that way, you better have a dealer license. And so that's what the dash one's about. Now, dash two would be the emergency clause, and that's just obvious, to try to make whatever you decide happen right away so we don't have get caught in this, gee, for the next 6 months before the bill takes effect, should they be dealers? So that's what the emergency clause is. I will tell you that there is some discussion about, it just came up late yesterday, whether the word possessory lien is the perfect term or whether it should be statutory lien. There may be a little tweaking there. But the general intent of Section 2 is to keep status quo as far as they're not being dealers when they're acquiring vehicles because they got stuck with them and they tried the auction and that didn't work and now they're selling them again or trying to sell them again, and for the record keeping. And I hope that helps bring you up to speed on this.
Thank you, Kelly. Any questions? Representative Greenland.
Kelly, was there any discussion about the magnitude of the exemption? Somebody shows up in the car and they have to get rid of them, they get rid of it, it happens once or twice or five times a year. That doesn't seem to me to make them a dealer, but if it happens that their business essentially is a major part of their business, some towing companies seem like they might do that. and they're selling 30 or 40 or 50 cars a year, that seems to me a different story. But did the Attorney General talk about the sort of incidental possession and sale of cars as opposed to it as a major part of the business?
Mr. Chair and Representative Greenleaf, no, I don't believe the Attorney General looked at volume. What they're looking at, I mean, the way the statutes read, you are, there are different exemptions from being a dealer, and one of them is if, like a person can own and sell their own cars and not be a dealer, as long as the cars were used for personal, household, or family use. The difference is if you sell more than five of those cars, the burden shifts from us to you to prove whether or not you're doing it for personal, family, or use.
So five is a number.
Well,
that comes up
it's there for Joe Public and Jill Public. But as far as saying, well, gee, businesses who have slow business or small businesses are exempt, but businesses that are in metropolitan areas and get stuck with an awful lot of cars, they should be dealers. Nobody's looked at that. It's really you either want them dealers or you don't. When the business is simply acquiring vehicles through legitimate means of being towed because they're abandoned or they've been wrecked and nobody wants to pay for them. Nobody, to my knowledge, looked at whether or not the interpretation of dealer is hinged on number. It's hinged on how you acquired the car.
Any other questions?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I talked to a constituent of mine who repairs cars. Mm-hmm. And how would cars that are given to the shop, I mean, if people just say, I don't want it, I'm going to give it to them, is that dealt the same way a possessory lien would be, or is there some other form they would have to do?
Mr. Chair and Representative Beyer, I would need to look, but you're saying the person just signs the title off to them?
Yeah, I'm assuming so, and then...
I mean, that isn't usually how somebody walks off from a repair bill, but okay.
Well, in this particular case, and I'm assuming the person had maybe power of attorney, an elderly gentleman came in, brought his car to be repaired, and when his son came to collect the car, the son said, we don't want Dad driving anymore, we don't want the car anymore, here.
Mr. Chair and Representative Beyer, my guess is that is a very rare exception to the rule. and I'd have to look. My guess is I know that if a business sells cars that were titled to the business, that they're exempt from being a dealer. For example, if a business owns several trucks that go out and do roadside repair or something like that, and then those trucks get to a certain age and the business wants to sell them, they can sell as many of their business vehicles as they want without being a dealer if they're titled. If the business were to put that car in their name and then want to turn around and sell it, they could probably do that. But I would need to research that. That's a pretty unusual circumstance that you're mentioning, and I'm not really sure.
And another question.
Follow up.
Revenue impact. If you're not doing this now, is checking these records... is this going to take more personnel or?
Mr. Chair and Representative Beyer, we see the Dash 1 amendments as far as the policy of them not being dealers, keeping it status quo. And we don't get that many calls today on, gee, I think this person's acting improperly. So the fact that there would be records there for us when we went out to investigate, we'd still go out and talk to them. We still try to go out and talk to them today. It's just whether or not they show us records. So I don't think there's an impact there. It's just we may actually have some records to see when we get there. Because we do try to follow up. Sometimes it's just a matter of an investigator showing up that somebody kind of does a big gulp, even though they don't show us records, and then decide to back off if they were doing something improper. If we find that somebody is selling vehicles without a dealer license and really should be licensed as a dealer, like, for example, let's pretend this went through and you said, you know, as long as you acquire them through abandoned liens or whatever, or possessory liens or whatever, and later on we find that somebody's got two cars mixed in on their lot that they just bought somewhere else, and we tell from looking at the paperwork that, you know, they didn't get them through the thing that you all said was okay, we would be able to fine them up to $5,000 for that car for being an unlicensed dealer. So it's not that it's going to be workload, but it'll be a more effective workload because we'll be able to tell what the heck's going on.
And even now, you're still talking about someone is going to have to report this
Mr.
you
Chair,
before
Byer,
you
that's
check
correct.
It.
Right.
And so, and how do you follow the auction? I think there had been some concern about the fact that some of these auctions aren't necessarily as public as they could be, and they aren't really advertised or that type of thing. And if it's brought, then it reverts to being their car.
Mr. Chair and Representative Byer, there are specific steps that a person is supposed to go through in order to do the auction, a certain where they're supposed to notice, where they're supposed to post, et cetera. By having the records maintained, when we write the rules, it would be our intent that they would have to show how they, let's just take towers because it could be the repair shop, what paperwork they got to show that they got, how they got the car, where they towed it from, even if it's just a piece of paper saying that such and such police department called them and they had to go out to such and such road and get it. So they'd have the paperwork of where they got the car, and they'd have to keep paperwork to show what they did to follow the auction laws. And then they would also have to show why they still have it on their lot, the fact that it didn't sell at the auction. So they'd have to have all that paperwork there in the file, and if they didn't do what they were supposed to do, then they would be in trouble either from us or the Department of Justice if they didn't follow through with what they were supposed to do on the auction laws. But see, having the records is what's missing today. Okay. It's all anecdotal. We don't know because we have nothing to check.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kelly, my guess is when these cars are sold and go back on the highway that there's probably no insurance on them. Do we know whether the person driving the car has liability at least on that vehicle, and is there a way to track it so if we don't have them violating the law?
Mr. Chair and Representative, these cars aren't any different than the cars that are sold between you and me, Joe Public out there with an ad in the newspaper. When a person... You have to realize that we have insurance companies that are hooked up to us electronically telling us when insurance policies are issued to a car or canceled to a car. Yeah. So by running the plate, any officer can tell whether any car on the road has insurance. When they apply for a title and registration, a person writes on the piece of paper, the application, their insurance company, a number. That may or may not be true. They may have gotten insurance and 2 days later cancel it. The electronic notification system that you all set up after the 93 session is what lets law enforcement know at any given time those vehicles are on the road, regardless of whether it's been titled recently or not, whether or not it has insurance on file with us. So I don't think this really changes anything, whether they bought the car from the tower, a dealer, or me, what I advertised in the paper, an old Toyota. It really doesn't change anything.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you.
Could I have, let's see, we got Elkins, is that Coe? Mr. Coe and Mr. Wagner, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Al Elkins. I'm representing the Oregon Tow Truck Association, and pleasure to be here today. We are one of the two groups that have asked for this legislation. We're representing the Oregon Tow Truck Association. First of all, I want to thank Mr. Chair Lorna Youngs, Director of DMV, for all her work during the interim at the direction of the Interim Transportation Committee. Kelly Taylor, for all her work with us and trying to understand the lien laws and what is required and what is not required. And a tip of the hat to Director of ODOT, Bruce Warner, for listening to me whine. I also would like to let the committee know that Kelly Taylor is right. What we're trying to do here today is take the process that we have been doing forever and put it into statute. Today we do not have to have a dealer's license, although some towers in the state do have. What we're talking about today only applies to vehicles acquired through lien process, and I want to, on this piece of paper that I've handed out to you, it's my attempt to explain two systems. On the left column, the current system that we're now under, and on the right-hand column, the system changes under House Bill 2455 when it should pass. The current system basically is allows us to do five steps, and I want to talk about each of those steps individually. Step one is when we tow a vehicle into our towing lot, we are required to tow a vehicle at the request of a police agency generally. And in most of the cases on these steps, we're talking about cars that have been towed for driving while intoxicated or driving while suspended, and all of our favorite tows, the abandoned vehicle tows. Those are what we're talking about today. In step two, after the vehicle comes to our lot, the owner picks up the vehicle, one, that's one option, or two, the owner decides not to pick up the vehicle and abandon it in our lot. That 2B is where what we're talking about today, because the state average that we're finding for impound tows is approximately 50% of the towers around the state. Cars are left in the lots. It's as high in some places as Portland is 75% of what's towed is left. And in the Cottage Grove,
just ask what you just said. Did you say 75% of the cars that are towed are left?
I did a survey of our, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, and I did a survey of our membership when we first introduced this bill and asked the question, how many are left in your lot for you to deal with? And one tower in Portland said 75%. He tows 1,110 cars a month, and 75% of those he has to deal with one way or the other to dispose of. In Cottage Grove and in Corvallis, it's 60 to 75% are left. Two towers reported to me to that those numbers. The abandoned vehicle tows, those are the cars along the highway that have those orange numbers on them, which usually is the time and the date that the officer has tagged them, and then within a 24-hour period, we are notified to come pick those up. In some portions of the state, Gary and Mike are called at 1 a.m. in the morning to go pick up an abandoned vehicle for whatever reasons. 90 to 95% of those vehicles are left on our lots. In some portions of the state, along the coast especially, we find that it's closer to 100%. Those cars usually are abandoned because they are absolutely on their last legs and nobody wants to deal with them. We're not only talking about cars that everybody in this room drives. We're also talking about things that we're asked to tow. Mr. Wagner, to my far right, has here a request from the Marion County Sheriff's Office to tow a 24-foot green boat. He did that. He also has provided the time that it took him to tow that, bring it to his lot, take it, and then dispose of it. And it cost him $122 to dispose of it after he took it through the process. He wants the committee to know that he has two more boat trailers currently under the same situation that he's had to tow. Another extreme that we're having to deal with that we dealt with 2 weeks ago in the Washington County area, Hillsborough area, we were asked to go tow a vehicle for the Oregon State Police that was a 78 Dodge van that was full of hazardous materials. The material was insulation that had come from a building in that area, and it was wrapped and sealed. The people that put it in the van knew what they were doing. We towed it. If we decide not to tow something, then we're taken off what they call the rotation list. So we are on a contract in most of the cities and counties of this state with police agencies, and we are told you will go out and do good and tow everything that we require of you. And so this gentleman towed this vehicle. When he went to dispose of it, he was told that that would cost him $600 to $800 to dispose of. Fortunately, he called me the day after the tow, and the day after he was told of the $600 to $800 bill, I contacted DEQ. They went out to the site and they looked at it. He was told at that time that he had 14 days to dispose of it. He worked again with DEQ. They worked with him, and they got the price down to $300. He had to have the vehicle towed to a certain spot where it was handled the appropriate way for hazardous materials, and he had to pay $300 out of his pocket. The vehicle was crushed, I understand, because it was still contaminated with hazardous materials. So those are the kinds of things that we are, as a industry, faced with. Now, on after 2B, after the vehicle is abandoned in our lot, we go through in number 3 what we call a lien process. The lien process is a very tight process that is, in effect, used probably more than any other process for any industry in this state. We are required through the statutes to send notice to the last registered owner, and then in 3B, the last registered owner has time to respond as outlined in the statute. The last registered owner then can either pick up the vehicle or abandon it in our lot. The assumption is always made when we tow a vehicle that the vehicle is registered and titled just the way it should be. Everybody has done that, has their name on it, has their address on it, and that is not necessarily the case. And over 20% of the time, from what I have found, 20 to 25%, people have not done their paperwork properly. Unfortunately, the person speaking to you right now is an example of that, and every time a vehicle is towed, this vehicle that I sold is towed or gets a parking ticket, I get a notice. And I've sent as much paperwork as humanly possible to DMV and to other folks to let them know that it's not my vehicle. And I'm still getting that. So what happens here is we can have a very short timeline from 5 days that we get the vehicle to when the LRO is notified by us. Prior to that, he or she is notified by the police department that it's been towed. But usually, it's a lengthy process for us, and it takes anywhere from 7 to 14 days to complete. The vehicle is then left in our lot, and we have a choice as to what to do with that. In step 4, after we have completed the process, we can take that vehicle and hold a public auction. As Ms. Taylor said before, the public auction steps and how to advertise are outlined in the statute. And people that I have spot checked with throughout our association, they can tell me where they have to post the notice, how many days they have to post the notice, how many notices they have to post. If a vehicle is less than so much money, what their timeline is for posting those notices and holding an auction. And if a vehicle is more than a certain amount of money, what they have to do in that sense. Now, let me tell you the situation that we're faced with every day in this state. If you tow a vehicle, and if two vehicles are towed at the same time in Portland for the same reason, okay, and one is a 1997 BMW, and the other one is a 1981 Toyota, the 1997 BMW will be towed to the police lot, which is called Seizure World. The 81 Toyota will be towed to Mr. Coe's lot, which is his towing lot. The reason it's towed to the sheriff's lot is because they know they can get probably the money from that individual. That individual and that 97 Beamer is interested in getting that car back. They know that on the 81 Toyota, more than likely, Mr. Coe will spend a good deal of time and money trying to find that LRO and not be able to get that, get the money out of that vehicle. In other words, they don't want to have to deal with a vehicle any more than we do. So after a public auction is held in 4A, then we decide what to do with that vehicle. In the towers that responded to my survey, 99% of them said that no one comes to their auctions. They have done everything that the statutes require to publicize that auction, and I think it has a lot to do with the value of the car that they're towing and the stigma that a towing company has in relation to what kind of vehicle they must be must be for sale. After that auction is held, then the person can do two things. They can either try to sell the car somewhere else, or they can take it to a wrecking yard. Right now, there is no... in the survey results that I got, most of the vehicles that we're sending to the wrecking yards are being given to the wrecking yard with the lien paper. In some cases, Mr. Wagner, the gentleman to my far right, he has a disposal service that will come by and for $5 a car will take the car away. If a tower is to dispose of the vehicle at a crusher and eliminate the middle person, either the wrecking yard or the service that Mr. Wagner has, they have to take the tires off, take all the liquids out of the vehicle, clean the vehicle inside to make sure there's no garbage there, and then take it to the crusher where it's crushed. On step five here, what we're trying to do is allow three and four to continue without having a dealer's license, which we are doing today. If you'll look on the right-hand column, everything that we're doing today is the same, even up to step five, under House Bill 2455. The Dash 6 amendments, which we support, as Kelly Taylor told you earlier, close that loophole so that we can have more than one bite of the apple. And B, it authorizes DMV to have, for the first time, access to all of our towing records, so that they can determine if that vehicle that we are selling has been one acquired through the lien service or two has been acquired from somewhere else. I hope this helps. The lien process, Mr. Chair, is a very complicated process. These gentlemen do it every day and can answer any questions that you might have or any questions about the towing situation.
You gentlemen have some testimony you want to offer too? Go ahead.
Yes, I'd like to comment that at each we have a weekly auction. At each auction, we sell several dozen cars.
I need to give your name and address for the record, please.
My name is Gary Coe, Speeds Towing in Portland.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, each week we hold an auction that we sell several dozen unclaimed or abandoned cars. At least a dozen of those, there's nobody that bids on them. We advertise our auction very heavily because we have so many cars. Most towers across the state are very small businesses, and quite often they only have a small handful of cars, so they get no bidders. Even with the large number of bidders that we have over a dozen cars every week that there are no bids on, and we have a wrecking yard that will give us $30 a piece for those cars if they are complete, and by complete meaning they have all the components, all the weight there, because they are in the scrap metal business. Most of these cars are acquired under the city contract, and the bill against the car at the time that we, the earliest time we can dispose of it through the lien process, is $685, and we get $30 for it. So it's a difficult challenge that we face with the with the number of unclaimed cars. Bigger problem than in the city is really the rural tower. I'd like you to know that the towers across Oregon, which there are a little over 600 towers across Oregon, that two-thirds of them are one- and two-truck operators. And if all of them were required to have a dealer's license in order to dispose of the vehicles that they get stuck with, that many of those one- and two-truck operators may end up not continuing in business, and there would be parts of the state that would not be served.
I'm Mike Wagner with Sanium Enterprises out of Lyons, Oregon. One more comment. As the further you go away from Portland, the worse the scrap metal situation gets. Gary gets the highest prices I've heard of in the state for his junkers, but that's because the crushing facilities are right there. So the further you go away from Portland, the more the transportation cost of having to get the vehicles back to Portland figures into, and that's why the rest of the state ends up getting little to nothing for their cars, has to give the cars away, because with the price of scrap being at all-time lows, and then you add in the price of transportation, which is, as you've been to the pumps lately, that's going up on a daily basis. There's no opportunity for the middleman to make any money if he has to pay anything for the car. So maybe shed a little more light onto the problem of how you dispose of the cars.
Thank you for your testimony, committee. Questions?
Yeah, is it the cost of the license you'd have to get, or all the hoops you'd have to jump through if you were forced to get a license?
Mr. Chair, Representative Zahner, I think it's a combination of both. This is the towing companies are dealing with a tremendous amount of paperwork now, and they don't just an expense that they're incurring themselves, and they just don't want to have it to incur any more expenses having to deal with these kinds of vehicles.
Follow up, Mr. When the police call you and tell you to tow a vehicle, what information do they give you? Do they tell you if it's stolen or not, or is there any way that they could help you by giving you more information?
Mr. Chair, Representative Zahner, I asked that question on a survey that I did a year ago, and they act as if it's none of our business. We are just providing a service. They will not give us any information at the scene. Generally, that is the case.
Follow-up, Mr. Would it help if they were required to give you what information you thought would be pertinent so you knew going right in when you go to pick that vehicle up, whether it was stolen, whether who the owner was, whether it was registered properly, or any of these other things?
Mr. Chair, Representative Zahner, they are required to give us information and statutes at this time.
Representative Greenland.
Thank you. Mr. Elkins, your testimony has really convinced me this is a rotten business, and I don't... I'll certainly make sure my grandkids don't get steered in the direction of becoming towers. But
Speed's got a good company.
Well, no, it must be terrible. I'm hearing about how horrible it is. But as a part of your testimony also, you're saying to me that you have at least one of your dealers that sells 10,000 cars a year and doesn't want to become registered as a car dealer? Is that the nature of your testimony?
Mr. Chair, Representative Graves, 10,000 cars a year, I'm sorry, did I...
1,200 a month, 90% of which he has to sell. That's 1,000 a month or something like that. Or
yes, Mr. Chair,
about
Representative
Graves, 10,000 a year?
I'm assuming the majority of those go to the junkyards for free, but I don't know what he does with those cars. I have not asked him what he does with those.
If I may follow. I mean, it seems perfectly logical to say when it's an incidental part of the business, you know, 10, 12 cars a year, you don't want to bother becoming a dealer. But your testimony is it doesn't matter. I mean, even if it's hundreds or thousands of cars a year that a single dealer sells, that a single company sells, they should not be registered as a car dealer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlock, Gary Coe, that particular tower has the abandoned vehicle contract for the city of Portland, is the reason why he has such a large volume of cars that are unclaimed. I used to have that contract, and it is appalling the condition of the cars that he receives. And if you walked through his lot, you would shake your head in disgust that somebody could treat a car like that. There are probably I'm going to guess his average sale price at about $100 for those cars, and he's gone through the whole process, just like we have, to lean them and store them for 30 days in order to dispose of them. I'd like to also, unfortunately, Mr. Representative Zahner is gone. I'd like to mention one other thing about the dealer's licenses, and that is that to obtain a dealer's license, you have to have a sign-off of the municipality or jurisdiction that you're in, be it a county or city. And most towing companies are required to be in industrial zones, and my towing company, I have not been able to get a city sign-off from the city of Portland. So I have to be in an industrial location according to the zoning laws, and yet I cannot get a dealer sign-off, a zoning sign-off on the dealer application from the city.
If I may follow, sir?
Follow.
How many cars a year do you sell?
About 4,000.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Byer.
Well, to clarify in my mind, when you say 4,000, these are 4,000 cars that you have not been able to sell at auction and wreck. Is that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Byer, no, we actually have a large advertised auction because of the volume of cars we have, and everything is sold at the auction.
Okay. So these are not, follow-up, sorry.
And
these are not the ones that you personally sell. These are the ones that you, they're sold at auction.
That's correct.
Do you have a percentage that you sell, that aren't sold at auction, aren't wrecked? Do you have any records of, because this is what this bill is trying to get to, really, is those cars that you personally take title to and own and sell.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Byer, the answer is no. Our business, every car is sold at auction except those that receive no bids, and then they're sold to that one scrapyard that will give us $30 for the complete car. But there are none that go through the process that is worth selling in our business. And I emphasize, while that's possible in a large volume market, the vast part of the state and the members of our association are very small businesses, and usually nobody shows up at the auction. It's just a bunch of junk and nobody shows up.
Did you have?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to address Representative Greenlick. Mr. Coe brought up the abandoned contract. I believe the tower pays the city per vehicle. Is that what?
Yes, sir. $5 a vehicle.
The tower pays the city $5 a vehicle to pick up those cars under that contract. I didn't want you to think that's the arrangement. That's a separate contract altogether. So there is. It's not a regular we go out and tow it contract. We pay the city for every vehicle under that contract that we tow. So I wanted to make that distinction.
He had a comment for me, too, I think.
Yes, Representative Byer. I think I can address the plight of the rural tower, since that's what I am. I'm a small-town tower up at Santiam Canyon. And our company processes 20 to 30 vehicles a month on the lien process, and that's done with two or three auction dates. Typically, no one comes to our auctions. We have... all the stuff that we perceive to be junk is taken to the appropriate wrecking yard or the scrapper or whatever it is. Our preference would be to, if a vehicle has value, our preference would be to sell it to a wrecking yard that might give us something for it if it was one that was a little nicer than the rest. Typically, in our operation, we might have four or five cars a month, two to five, two to six, that would represent a vehicle that a wrecking yard wouldn't pay anything for, but that probably had a value on the street of $200-$300. And so this is where this bill would help us, is we're able to try and minimize our losses.
I know that the issue has come up several times that we're selling cars, we should be a dealer. The difference between us and a dealer is that the dealer enters into the agreement planning to make money because he's bought the car at a price he assumes he can sell for a profit. We enter into our relationship with the car knowing that 50% of the time the car will be left with us, and that 99% of the time, that and maybe 99.9% of the time, that vehicle is not even going to make the amount of money that our tow bill is. So we're always selling vehicles to recoup part of a loss. That's a whole different thing than going into the business trying to make a profit, because you know cars are incidental for us as a residual leftover item of our operations of trying. Our business is towing cars. We would prefer that everyone picked their cars up and we got paid for every tow that we did. That would be a perfect world. That isn't the world we operate in. And so we're forced to get into this business of disposing of cars in order to. And if we didn't dispose of them, we'd have lots with thousands of cars stacked up, and you know we'd have cities and counties on us with this terrible eyesore. So,
thank you.
One question. Do you guys ever pick up any cars that have the materials from meth labs in them? And if you do, how do you get rid of that stuff?
Mr. Chair, in the 70s and 80s, we dealt with that heavily. We called them the meth labs on wheels, the motor homes that traveled up and down I-5. At first, law enforcement didn't want anything to do with them, but through the pressure that this body had, we were able to work out an agreement where they would help. We would tow them to their lots, and they would dispose of them. We find a lot of, even in regular cars, a lot of drug paraphernalia and things of that nature that we are required to dispose of.
Thank you. One more question. Representative Mayor.
What is a typical tow fee? I know they're all different depending on the length, but a typical tow fee and then a typical storage fee for a car vehicle.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Mayor, they vary from each county to county, city to city. They're usually set by contract rates. We as an association do not follow rates at all or record rates, but I could call three or four from different areas of the state and get those rates and get them to you if you'd like.
Well, all I'm getting is typically, you know, $50, $100, $150, or, you know, that's all I'm getting.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mayberry, in a hearing about 2 weeks ago, Monty King said he just got a tow that day for $49.95 or something like that. So and he said he bragged that it was across the city. So I don't know if there was any storage involved at all. It all depends on the city and the rate set by their
close enough, ballpark. And a storage fee, typically?
Storage rate in the Portland metro area is what a day, Gary, is set by the contract. Do you remember?
$16 on the contract. $16 a day on the contract.
$16? $16 a day on the contract.
Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate you.
Thank you.
Your testimony. Could I have Deb Elkins, Robert Anderson, I believe, and Frank Warrens.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, forgive my voice. I'm losing it, so hopefully you'll hear all my testimony. Of course, maybe you'd like me to lose my voice. For the record, my name is Deb Elkins. I'm the director of the Northwest Automotive Trades Association. We represent about 900 small businesses in Oregon. They're in the business of repairing cars, their body shops, their repair shops, their auto recyclers, their tire dealers, and their transmission repair shops. I'm here today to ask that you would support House Bill 2455 and the Dash 1 and 2 amendments. The businesses I represent, they currently are exempt from dealer licensing requirements. And what this bill does and its amendments is ask that we continue with that current practice. But the Dash 1 amendments and 2 go a step further. As Kelly Taylor testified earlier, it asks for us to maintain those records so that the DMV or anyone could come in and say, just exactly, Mr. Shop Owner, how did you acquire that vehicle? It goes another step further and will even fine us in the event that we have acquired a car not through the lien process, but because we had chosen to purchase a car for resale. I'm not going to go into all the details of the lien process because I'm not one a technical expert on it, but I can tell you that the steps that are taken and the notification that is done gives any security interest holder and or vehicle owner plenty of time to pick up that vehicle. We are not in the business of selling cars. We're in the business of repairing them. So we want the car to get off our lot just as quickly as possible. NATA is representing this exemption because we feel the lien process is the best tool to regulate the disposal or the sale of an unclaimed vehicle. Truly, this legislation will not open the proverbial floodgates and where Oregon will see more dealers or more unlicensed dealers, excuse me, than ever before. That's just not the case. What this bill does is ask for you to let us continue to practice the way we've been dealing with unclaimed vehicles since, as you heard earlier, for many, many years. We do believe this exemption is necessary, though, for you folks to think about, as we believe, is there are very fundamental differences between an auto repair shop and a car dealer. Dealers are in the business of selling cars, and we're in the business of repairing them. Dealers sell cars that they purchase near or below market to sell for a profit. We sell unclaimed cars through public auction to recover parts, labor, and storage that is usually at a loss. Dealers select cars for quality resale or acquired through trade-ins. For us, cars are driven to our lot, towed to our lot, our facility, with either mechanical and or body damage. For dealers, cars are sold in usually good running condition, depending on which one you purchase it from. However, for us, an unclaimed car is not usually worth the cost to be repaired, or it wouldn't have been left in our lot. For car dealers, the more cars they sell, the better. For us, the fewer cars that we sell that have been unclaimed, the better. For used car dealers, they select and purchase that car for resale. We, however, do not choose unclaimed vehicles. And I think the best is that selling cars as a dealer, you're acquiring a great customer database. Trust me, when a car is unclaimed in our lot, they're not typically a repeat customer. Please don't misunderstand. NATA supports dealer licensing requirements if, in fact, we're in the active business of buying and reselling cars. Our organization has long reported that. We have been on committees that have stated that. But what we're doing is just asking that in this event that a car is unclaimed, that we do not need to go through the costly cost of becoming dealers. The licensing fees, the dealer education, the extra liability insurance, the bonding. We're looking at approximately $1,000 a year to add to our expense column when, in fact, we're going to dispose of these vehicles at a loss. We probably won't cover our repair, our parts or labor, or our storage. So House Bill 2455 and the amendments, they give repairers and tire dealers the ability to use the lien process when disposing of an unclaimed vehicle. The bill also gives DMV the oversight authority necessary to ensure that we are, in fact, not buying and selling cars like a dealer. We're just trying to recover our costs. A good example is my car is broke down alongside the road, and a tow truck comes and picks my car up, takes it to a repair shop. It gets there, and I find out that the repairs are going to be more than my $1,500 car is worth. So what I do, not personally, but what I can tell you many do, is leave that car in a repair shop's lot. They may or may not have spent any time or money in that vehicle, but they're put in a position of having to dispose of it. What those that are in opposition to our bill would like you to believe is that we are, in fact, selling a car that has some equity in it, that the car is of actual value. Well, if the owner of the vehicle isn't interested in having it repaired or doesn't believe there's any value in it, why would we? We did survey our membership because when this issue first came up, I needed to know just exactly how many businesses were using this process, but more importantly, how many cars they were selling a year. I can tell you that it was all over the board. I had some businesses that shared with me that, you know, I've used it once or twice, Deb, in 10 years. Others have said on the average of once a month, that would be 12 a year. I even had some say, you know what, I would just as soon push that thing out in the street and let the towing companies come and pick it up. So I can tell you that the responses were very enlightening. This really concludes my testimony. I think you've probably heard some of the best testimony you could have from Kelly Taylor. She's been great at helping us to look at the lien process and to determine what we might be able to do to tighten it up, to make those on the outside world feel a little more comfortable with the procedures we're using to try to recover our costs. But what I'd really like you to do is hear from the two gentlemen that I brought with me today. Both are members of mine. Mr. Anderson on my left, your right, is a board member of mine. And Mr. Frank Warrens on my right is a member of mine and has been very active in my legislative committee. So if I may, I'd like to turn it over to them.
Excuse me. Chair Brown, members of the committee, can you hear me all right there? Thank you. My name is Bob Anderson, and I am an independent auto repair or own an independent auto repair shop here in Salem, Oregon called AJ's Auto Repair. And we've been here for about 30 years. So a lot of the discussion that we've heard this morning is based on the assumption that there is some equity in these automobiles that we end up with. And if there were a marketplace that was such that they would drop off $2,000 automobiles for me and then leave them with me so I could sell them and make money, that would be a pretty good deal. But we really make our money repairing cars. We end up with automobiles that have no equity in them at all. So these vehicles come to us in a really pretty normal fashion. And the concept is always that we would repair the vehicle, collect the money, and then return the vehicle to the owner. But what can and sometimes does go astray in this process is that the cost of repairing the automobile exceeds the value of the automobile. In other words, there's just no equity in it. When we go through the lien process, many, many times we find out the car's been refinanced three times already and they got the title. So, again, they come to us, most of the ones that we have to go through the lien process with, come to us behind a tow truck. I've heard discussion that if we were able to do a better job of analyzing these vehicles, we wouldn't get involved in this process. But after 30 years of doing cars, my shop was selected as the number one auto repair shop in the nation a year ago. I still haven't figured out how to analyze these cars while they're on the back of a tow truck coming off I-5. So they get to us in whatever condition they're in. So we don't get a choice in regards to whether we're involved in this process or not. So what always happens, however, when there is no equity left in the car, is we end up being the dumping grounds for junk automobiles, and we got to figure out how to get rid of them. The lien process, of course, is what we've always used to do that with. So every year in our industry, nationwide, we lose thousands of very valuable parking spots to these junk vehicles. And then we're forced to pay highly compensated auto repair technicians to move them back and forth to make room for customers that pay their bills and pick up their cars. So the assumption that $15 a day or $16 a day is an adequate price to pay to store these cars doesn't make any sense at all when these repair technicians charge out between $60 and $70 an hour to repair cars. So nonetheless, we have to dispose of these things, even if we're going to donate them to the high school or Chemeketa or whatever, and we've done that before with a lot of these cars. We still have to go through the lien process, and besides the cost of getting the car to us, we're into it for another $100 or $150 by the time we do the administrative fees and go through that process. So if all the things that I've mentioned so far don't clearly illustrate that we don't fit in the same box as auto dealers, Then I'd like to mention Oregon Revised Statute 18206, which mandates that if we make any money on these automobiles, we have to return over and above any of the administrative costs and storage, we have to return that to the county treasurer. So we're literally mandated away from being able to make any money on these cars. So there are many aspects about this dealer licensing issue that do make sense. There are some things that need to be done. The record-keeping side of it makes sense. However, most auto repair shops have to start an invoice when these cars come in. By state law, they have to give consumers prices to repair the cars, and so that paperwork's all in place. And as we lose money on these automobiles, or if we did make money, that also has to be part of the year-end process whereby you do your taxes. So most businesses, and I have examples, I brought four or five examples of what can happen and what usually does happen when these cars get dropped off. So thank you very much, Mr. Brown and the committee.
Thank you.
Chairman Brown, members of the committee, my name is Frank Warrens. I own a second-generation automotive repair business, which has been in operation now for 57 years in Northwest Portland. You've heard an abundant amount of testimony this morning, clearly drawing a vivid line between us in the business of repairing cars or towing vehicles, setting us apart from car dealers. Certainly, if there may be some exceptions where people in the repair business may also be in the business of selling cars, and I know of a few in the Portland area, and rightfully they should be licensed as dealers to keep the marketplace a fair and level playing field. But speaking specifically for myself in the repair business, it clearly is, again, you heard this morning, there's when we have to resort to filing a possessory lien in order to recover our costs for repairs, or nowadays even the estimation of repairs, which can run $150 to $200 or $300 depending on the vehicle, before we even know what the cost of the repair is going to be, and oftentimes that's the majority of the labor that goes into a repair. The owner of the vehicle, if he doesn't have the funds for whatever reason to cover that cost, usually we announce what the initial diagnostic charge is for repairing a car and get their commitment, but it can go beyond that. I personally haven't had a great deal of difficulty because we're very careful in bringing our customer along with the costs that we may be incurring. However, there are, and I've had two occasions in the past several years where we did have to file a possessory lien because the person, for whatever reason, either disappeared, chose not to have the car repaired and then disappeared, or for whatever reason, we were stuck with the car. The lien process has been one that we have used very sparingly, but it's there for a purpose. We are not a car dealer. We don't make profit, as you've already heard on several occasions this morning. It's just a means for us to recover part of the money that we have invested in paying our mechanics or technicians, and they get paid regardless of whether we collect the money from the owner or not. It's our kind of a last resort means of allowing us to stay in business. If we were encumbered with the necessity of having to have a dealer's license in order to, before the fact, in order to have to sell a vehicle in the lien process, that would just be another additional burden and cost of business that, in my opinion, is totally unnecessary. Again, because we are not car dealers. We're in the repair business, and this is a final resort for us to recover our costs. I think that from what I've heard this morning, that it's pretty clear that there is no profit in filing a possessory lien and selling a car either at auction or after the fact. And that concludes my comments, Chairman Brown, and members of the committee. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Questions, Manny? Representing Greenlight and then Representing Milton.
Well, I want to thank you all for appearing. Thank Mr. Anderson for taking care of my car last week.
You're welcome.
And Mr. Howells for being here as a constituent. And let me ask my constituent what's perhaps a hard political question. I think I'm convinced by your testimony that auto repair shops are different than auto dealers. But I think I'm also convinced by your testimony that auto repair shops are different than towing companies. And it seems to me there's a great deal of difference between having to sell a car a dozen times a year or five times a year or 20 times a year from selling 4,000 cars a year. Does that difference seem right to you as well?
Chair Brown, Representative Greenlake, I learned more than I wanted to know about the towing business this morning, but it definitely made up my mind that I'm in at least the right half of this business of this concerning this issue. So I believe that at least taking their word as being statement of fact, that in a much larger sense, they probably don't make any more money than those of us in the repair business, or it sounds to me like that it's just a way for them to reduce or cut some of their losses. So not being in a tow business, and I've hired Mr. Coe over the past number of years, and I know a little bit about the business, but I don't think they're any better off than we are, at least listening to them this morning, with all the hoops that they have to jump through and space to store all these vehicles that they have in a volume like that would be a tremendous amount of cost, and I really doubt if they recover anywhere near 100% of that cost by storing those vehicles and ultimately selling them for little or no profit.
Thank you, sir.
Representative's honor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have these charitable organizations that are always advertising, will come and pick up your old wreck and take it. Why don't we just have those people just tow those cars off the highways and be done with it? Because I assume everyone else is losing money on it, so...
Chair Brown, Representative's honor, if it were as simple as that, and I do get involved to some degree. I do some minor repairs on donated vehicles that are ultimately donated through a church to needy people. If in fact they comply with all the paperwork requirements, usually those vehicles, my understanding is that they're donated with a clear title. And so it's kind of a separate sort of thing. If we were to take the cars that we got under the possessory lien laws, there are costs incurred there, and I don't know that you can actually mix those two and make sense. There's probably somebody here that can answer better than me in that respect. So.
One follow-up. I live in Woodburn, and if I'm a drug dealer like a lot of the guys I see down there on the corner all the time,
your neighbor.
And they pick up a car, and on the plate it won't expire on the license plates for a year, a year and a half, or whatever. That car is very valuable to me then. I can do my drug work, and anytime someone reads that license plate, it shows it's registered to somebody else because they haven't changed it. How do we control that? And I'm sure, I think there's probably times where the plates on that car are more valuable than the car itself.
Representative Brown, Representative Zahner, I think the best answer to that question would be if we looked at the lien process and how we're using it today. And if there are some flaws, then we need to look for those flaws. But I think an easy solution of putting us in a dealer licensing or requiring a dealer certification box, the simple answer is not always the best answer. And I think that issue could be examined by looking at the licensing, or the lien process.
One last follow-up. In regards to that, it seems to me it's not the cost of the license fee that's bothering you. It's the paperwork that's involved. And, of course, to get a hold of these drug dealers, we got to do some tracing and some paperwork. So
Representative Brown, Representative Zahner, I think, and I don't know this for sure, but I know that even some of the materials that are required on the to perform, to be a dealer, are very expensive. And when my folks are looking at the economy that they're trying to operate in today, everything that adds more cost to doing business, they're examining, they're cutting, and to ask us to add any more right now, it just it would hurt us. It would hurt us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
They're there all the time.
Thank you, folks, for your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chris really studying his blood.
Could we have Monty King, Eric Page, and Gary Sargent, please? Thank you. Oh, Monty, would you like to go ahead? Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Monty King, Executive Director, Oregon Independent Auto Dealers, Education Director, Oregon Dealer Education School, and 15-year advertiser with Auto Trader Magazines in my past life. I want to thank all the participants and all the work groups have been talking for the last 3 or 4 or 5 years about this. I would also like to thank the people who have been talking for the last 15 to 20 years about this. This is not new. We've been talking about this for a long time. No one wants to have a dealer's license. That's not surprising. And we're not asking anybody else to have a dealer's license. What we're asking for is if they sell to consumers, that they have a dealer's license. So if they want to get rid of all the junk, all the rotten stuff, they want to send it to the wrecker, they want to do this or that with it, that's fine. Go ahead and do it. We don't want you to have a dealer's license. We're willing to say, you know, what's the right level for a mechanic who has to take vehicles? We're willing to look at what's the right level for those types of people. Is 5 the right level? We've offered that for those mechanics. So they don't have to have a dealer's license. We've offered unlimited exemptions to dealer licensing to all the tow operators who sell vehicles with the lien process there is now, with the public auction process there is now, and as wholesale dealers, plus 5. So we're not really talking about the 10,000, 20,000 vehicles. Well, actually, we're talking about 100,000 vehicles. We're talking about 52,000 to the consumers. We're talking about the ones that go to the consumers, and that is all. All this other stuff is extraneous. I'm hoping that every business person in this room is making money. If they weren't making money, they wouldn't be a business owner anymore. So I'm always curious why people say they're losing a lot of money everywhere else, but they're still in business, but I know that 19% of my members who were supposed to renew last month are out of business today. So I know that the situation is tough. We support the amendments on the notifications, the paperwork issues. Those should have been done 30 years ago. There needs to be some kind of separation here between the needs of the tow operators and the needs of the mechanics and the needs of the dealers. This bill certainly isn't it. This bill is the opening of Pandora's box for the dealer industry, for the curbers, for the 20,000 mechanics, for all the boat operators who don't need dealer licenses anyway. But, you know, you don't have to have a dealer's license to sell boats. This bill will destroy the entire public auction process that all the states have. So if Oregon wants to be the first state to do this, wow, that's pretty exciting, I guess. But the other states don't allow unlimited car sales to the public by people who have taken liens. They do the same thing Oregon's been doing for a lot of years, the public auction process. This bill is a reward for not using the public auction process correctly and legally.
And this didn't just come up last week, year. We've been talking about it for years. We've been complaining about it for years. You can expect a few less licensed dealers if this bill passes, because there's a bunch of tow operators who now have dealer licenses who are going to let them go. They want the car dealer process to sell to consumers. Remember, only talking about sales to consumers. Without the dealer licensing, the government oversight and the consumer protection, they don't want to pay for it either. I want to know who's going to pay for all this paperwork process, by the way, because my guys don't want to pay for it. We're already paying enough money for oversight, and we even supported a tripling of our dealer fees last session to make sure that those reporting and those government oversight process was done correctly. We stepped up. It's not about tow operators selling cars. They can at the public auctions. You want to do away with the public auction process? This bill does it, because they've been hiding the public auction process for years. I worked for Auto Trader for 15 years. My assistant over there worked for him for 10 years. We never had one, at least in my area, advertisement of a public auction from a tow operator. In the Auto Trader magazine, Auto Over Under, Truck Over Under, RV, truck, boat, whatever you want to call it, there's 8 books there, and I never had one ad in 15 years, and neither did the 11 people who eventually were working for me as salespeople. So are they using the public auction process correctly? No. We went through every phone book in Oregon and looked for any kind of an advertisement of public auction. There isn't one. There's some photos here that I'd like delivered. If they already been delivered. Okay, try and pick out who's the licensed car dealer and who's not. You can't do it. If they're going to display vehicles for sale to the public, they should be a dealer, a licensed dealer. They want the legislature to make their illegal actions legal because they say they've been doing it for a while. They haven't been doing it forever. You go back 20 years, you didn't see the lots they have open now. All those cars are being sold by licensed car dealers, but now they're selling so many of them, my licensed car dealers can't operate in that system anymore. They're going out of business because they're losing so much money. This bill allows them to not adequately publicize their public auctions, not that they ever did, not disclose significant defects to consumers, such as title brands. Remember, we're only talking about consumer sales. Not responsible under unfair trade practices. Can sell vehicles without being responsible for DEQ. Not have dealer education for consumer sales like the rest of the industry. They're in direct competition with at least half of the dealers in Oregon, the smaller, lower dealers, the one mom-and-pop stores. They don't have to prove compliance with local zoning laws. In fact, what the one gentleman said was basically, I can sell cars illegally, but the city won't let me sell them legally because they won't let him sell cars there, so he can sell cars there without telling them. That doesn't make sense to us. What's going to happen with this regulation stuff, and I just can't get it out of DMV, but somebody's going to have to go out there. Somebody's going to have to look. There's 20,000 mechanics out there. There's 600 tow operators. Somebody's got to go out there and do the inspections. And it's not going to cost any money. Well, there is going to cost money. It's going to come out of roads. It's going to come out of bridges, because it's not going to come out of the dealers who are already paying for all their regulation, plus the illegal dealer operations looks at, too. Well, I think we pay for some of that. Tow operators get vehicles as part of their business operation with tow license plates. They should sell them as a business. They know they're going to get the cars when they go into that business. They know they have the public auction process to do that with. Then they sell them to low-income public to collect income they charge on the storage and tow on the tows. Sure, my tow costs $49 from South Salem up to here to Cliffs Auto Repair. What's the bill on an abandoned one out on the highway? It's not $49. All those tow rates are in their contracts.
They melt all of that stuff into their contract rates when they make the contract with the city, so that all that is taken care of, so they can make enough money off the other people to pay for the other stuff. So I hesitate to say anything about, am I losing money, when I can charge more, and it's in the contract and how they do it. They're the ones signing the contract. Does it make a difference to the legitimate where he gets the cars he sells to the public? No. We have to have a dealer's license to sell dealer to dealer. Maybe we shouldn't have that anymore. Maybe we should get rid of all that kind of stuff. 52,000 cars last year they sold to the public. That's a lot of cars. And I think it's a lot more than that. What is it? And if you pass this bill, next year it'll be 100,000. And there's going to be a lot more car lots out there, but they're not going to have dealer licenses. We're offering a better compromise. We're offering 5 vehicles a year. Maybe we should talk about how many to the entire vehicle industry repair group. That takes care of literally almost everybody out there. We're offering exemption for all vehicles sold by the tow operators of them to wholesalers, wreckers, whoever, to dispose of the vehicles. What we're not offering is an exemption, except for the first 5, to the consumers. We know tow operators have dealer's licenses, too. They should be selling these vehicles in a business-like fashion. If nobody's showing up for the auction, maybe they ought to advertise it a little bit, because I guarantee you nobody else knows about it. But I want to back up. There are a lot of tow operators who are doing great auctions and having large auctions and being very successful at it. They're using everything the right way. But what this bill does rewards all the people who don't do their business in the right way. It's unfair to the used car industry and the thousands of people who depend on it, the thousands of dealers, the thousands of their families, tens of thousands of their employees. It's unfair to consumers. There is a better way to compromise on these issues than this opening of the Pandora's box, because this is going to be huge. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, would you like me to repeat that?
I'll read your testimony. Thank you. Go ahead, sir. The next, Eric.
Chairman Brown, representatives, my name is Eric Page, and I've been a licensed dealer in the state for 22 years, bonded, insured. I currently sit as legislative chairman with Independent Auto Dealers. And in the last 4 to 5 years, the Independent Auto Dealers has cleaned their industry dramatically. We have done Kerber bills. We have done education bills. We have changed our industry dramatically. The point of this House Bill 2455 is exactly opposite of what we've done in our industry. We don't like regulation any better than anybody else does. But in a consumer-friendly world, it is a requirement and it is something that happens. That's the type of world that we live in these days. What my concerns are with this bill is it's completely against everything in the retail consumer world now. It will open up doors to fraudulent transactions, criminal type activity, cars being sold to people that don't want to have their vehicles registered with the state of Oregon. There are a huge number of vehicles being processed through the tow operators through their sales. And I am not, it's not that I don't feel for the tow operators in the large number of cars, and I will say large number of cars they're processing, but there are ways of which to do it and do it legally, which is the auction process. There are several tow operators in this town alone that I know that are know of just by visual drive-by that actually have vehicles out there for retail sale. They have prices posted on the window, and they're selling them in a retail fashion. We are regulated to protect the consumer. We are regulated to do our business in a consumer-friendly, legal, upfront manner. Through DMV, through DOJ, many different government sources, we stay within certain guidelines. At this particular juncture, the tow operators are operating without regulation, and now they're asking to legally do it. I believe that would put a lot of consumers in a jeopardized situation, continue to, which is going on now, and I think a serious consideration on this bill should be to not let this bill pass. There are options being offered for the mechanics, and we don't have a problem with the process of the mechanics moving vehicles that they acquire through the process of the lien process. I think those numbers are relatively small, and that the shops don't end up with vehicles in large numbers that they have to dispose of to square their bills. Most of the repair shops, I believe, are astute enough to know when a car comes in, first of all, that they write an estimate with a customer and are informing the customer of potential charges and find out whether this person is going to pay or not. I think those numbers are pretty small in the world of how many cars they may acquire. So our attempt is to not put repair shops in financial jeopardy by licensing them, because I don't believe that those numbers would support that they really need to be licensed. But there are some tow operators moving huge numbers by their own testimony. Several operators out of Portland, and the numbers are in the thousands. Huge numbers of vehicles that are being moved to the public's hands, not via the auction process, which is what the way it's supposed to be done. Thank you.
Thank you, Gary. I know I said that wrong, and thank you, Eric. Gary, please.
That's okay. Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Gary Sargent. I operate Sargent's Auto City out of Portland, Oregon. I'm a third-generation automobile dealer. My family's been in the automobile business in the city of Portland since 1949. I'm also the East Regional Director of the Independent Automobile Dealers Association in Portland. After hearing the testimony today from the Oregon Tow Association and the mechanics, it is very apparent that there are two different animals. I'm going to speak to some personal experience with a tow truck operation in Portland, and to what I believe is a normal course of operation for a mechanic shop. When a mechanic takes in a vehicle and writes an estimate, they have the owner of that vehicle sign an authorization to do an estimate. Then after they've presented that estimate, they also get an authorization to do the repair. Now, a good business operator would know that if you're looking at a $200 automobile and this person is authorizing you to do $3,000 worth of work or even $1,000 worth of work, first course of business is to ask, how are you going to pay for it? And since we live in a world of plastic, most businesses get a pre-authorization on a Visa or a MasterCard or American Express. Then they proceed with those repairs, getting paid for through that process. The number of vehicles that a mechanic shop would deal with, I would think, if they're doing their business correctly, would probably be somewhere less than five vehicles a year where they would have that process, that they would have to file a possessionary lien. yet their constituency there led you to believe that these people are having vehicles towed to their property, dropped off, and then basically abandoning those vehicles. As a business operator, if I was running that business, I would have in hand the information of the owner of that vehicle, and after I've made an estimate on the repair and they say I don't want to repair that vehicle, it's not worth that, I would inform them of the process to come pick their vehicle up, and if they didn't, I would pay $49.95 and have it towed right over to their house and parked in front of their house. Then pursue them through the small claims process to recover my expense that was incurred by their authorization of the repair order to initially give that estimate. That's one remedy. That would alleviate them from ever having vehicles dumped on their property from non-authorizing consumers. In Portland, we have tow truck operators that look at the towing. I could not believe some of the testimony that I heard in towing, signing city contracts and losing money. Okay, everyone loses money on sometimes when they get involved in a contract. That's to a point. But why sign a contract with a city if it's a definite loser? This is an extreme profit center for the tow company. They take the vehicles in Portland. This is at several tow operations. They take the vehicles and they go through the possessionary lien process. These vehicles are offered for sale, advertised as tow sales, offered for sale, and by their own testimony today, they sell about 4,000 vehicles a year through that process. That's one operator. There's many in the city of Portland. My personal experience with my personal experience with a tow truck operator, I know we've all got teenage daughters, so I'm going to presume everyone has their relatives. My daughter had parked in an apartment complex in the wrong spot. There happens to be signs saying that it's patrolled and your vehicle will be towed if you don't have a authorized parking permit. It was a Friday night. My daughter comes back from seeing a movie with her friend. Her car is towed. We think it's stolen. After several frantic phone calls to the different police departments, we find out that vehicle was in fact towed. The tow bill, as there's a question raised, how much was it? The initial tow bill was $185 for the tow. Okay, I'm in the automobile business. We pay to have a vehicle towed between $35 and $50. That's our cost. That's our hard cost, calling up and having one towed. My cost to my daughter was $185. Now, this was a Friday night. Oh, you want to pick it up on Saturday? We're closed Saturdays and Sundays, but for another $35, but of course it's another day, so that's $50 a day, plus a $35 fee to have you come down, have someone come down and open up so you can get your vehicle back, we're now adding and adding and adding. And this is a standard practice with tow truck operators. Many of them target that particular situation by posting signs in inconspicuous locations. I heard of a tow truck operator in the city of Portland that had targeted the convention center, an abandoned Rustler Steakhouse across the street from the convention center, posted some signs on that, and then watched people park. Now, we're talking a building, a major parking lot area with boarded up windows and a few signs here and there that were not very legible, especially at night, since they're black signs, black and white signs. So they would set up now I'm testifying to this as hearsay. This was told to me. They would have a lookout who would watch the people park their car in this lot, go over to the convention center for an event, and once they were inside that event, the tow truck would then come and pick up their vehicle and tow it off, time and time and time again. incurring great expense to people. That it's unbelievable what a license to steal is happening here. This then some of these vehicles, obviously, by the time this dollar amount at $50 a day adds up, those vehicles, maybe they are $400 or $500 cars, maybe they're worth more. These vehicles are sold at an auction, and then here comes the revolving door. They're bought at public auction by drug dealers because the car's got current license plates. They're bought by curbstoners. This is a great avenue for curbstoners to obtain vehicles to resell, because that title or that possessionary lien, they title the vehicles, they resell these vehicles. It's also another avenue for mechanics to buy these vehicles that are in maybe need of mechanical repair, maybe they're not. The tow truck operators portray these vehicles that they sell at auction as just hunks of iron. Well, they do sell them for more than $100. These mechanics take these vehicles, they make these minor repairs, and they set them out in front of their places of business and claim they want to recover the expenses that they've got incurred in repairing those vehicles. This is a clear-cut automobile dealer operation, and they should be licensed. And that way, by being licensed, that would give the Department of Motor Vehicles the ability to go in and find out if that drug dealer bought that car or who's owning these vehicles. Some of them even go through the cycle several times. Every time those cars leave that auction yard, they don't have insurance on them. They don't have a facility there to where the ones with no license plates are put right back out on the road driving with no license plates. And I think our law enforcement officers have a lot better things to do than chase vehicles without current license plates and be checking for car insurance. But that's a reality. These cars are out there, and then when they are involved in an accident, they're abandoned, and then the cycle starts over again. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Zonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would have asked this probably of the tow operators earlier, but I didn't have the pictures. But I see a $45 after-hours gate fee. Is that a special thing you can do, or is that in statute, or is that... Because you just talked about your daughter running into that.
Right. That is something that I guess that they can charge pretty much. There's, when you asked the question earlier, I believe, of how much it cost, the tow truck operators were stumped, because they didn't really want to admit that they really have, from my understanding, somewhat carte blanche to charge whatever they want.
One other question. I see on signs where they say they're advertising cars. Could that qualify as advertising for, under statute, for advertising for auction? Could they get around it that way by doing the signs as opposed to putting it in a newspaper?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Zonner, I do not believe that qualifies for the posting of a public auction. My intent with these pictures was, my question to you was, can you tell the difference between the licensed dealers and the tow operators by the pictures? The answer is there are no licensed dealers in those pictures.
Trick question.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Byer.
I probably should just not say anything at all. But I am a little dismayed, I guess, at generalizations that have been made here against certain industries. And I know that you guys have been hit in the past by these same type of generalizations, you know, used car dealer's reputation. And you're kind of generalizing that with the tow truck drivers right now. And it concerns me. I know testimony on the 4,000 vehicles that this dealer has sold were sold at auction. And he testified to that, that he wasn't selling as a personal dealer. So I think it's, I'm not real happy, I guess, right now at some of the testimony today. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Any other questions? Thank you for your testimony today. Could I have...
Could I respond to Representative Beyer? Is that okay?
Sure.
I would like to make an apology from our testimony if some rash generalizations were made, and I don't, my intention certainly would not be to lump every tow operator into the same grouping. Because much like the automobile industry, we have our own problems even with licensed dealers. So does the tow industry. They have towers that are operating within the bounds that they should. The problem with House Bill 2455 is it opens up an exposure door for the operations to run without regulation and with, let's say, reckless abandon. But I didn't, my intention in my testimony personally was to not generalize that the tow industry as a group per se operates way out of the bounds, but there are certain operators in the industry creating large numbers of vehicles put out to the public that should have gone through a different process. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I assume maybe you didn't, but that's pretty much the way the testimony came across today, and I had some concerns about it.
Thank you. Thank you. Could I have William Meegan and Al Hutchinson and Marlon Mitchell, please? And committee, we're not going to take this to a work session today, so we're just getting testimony. Thank you, gentlemen.
I'll go ahead and start. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. My name is Al Hutchinson. I'm from Corvallis, Oregon. I've been a licensed Oregon motor vehicle dealer for 26 years. I was the chairman of the Dealer Education Committee for the Oregon Independent Auto Dealers Association from its formation in 1998 and for 3 years afterwards. The mission of the Education Committee for the Dealer Association was to educate all the dealers in the state as to the laws and regulations in Oregon. Why did this come about? We previously had a very high rate of complaint with the Department of Justice Consumer Affairs Department. We were number two or number three every year. We became proactive. We thought it was important that we at OIADA would get legislation passed and launch this education program for all the dealers, and we created a program, trained the instructors, and within 2 years, we were number 13 on that list of complaints. So we had a very, very significant improvement because of educating our dealers. Our dealers now understand the laws. They follow them. The majority of the complaints that were received by the DOJ were coming from new dealers who flat didn't understand the laws and the regulations in the state. And now that we do, each year we require our dealers to have continuing education, 5 hours per year. House Bill 2455, which you're now considering, if put into law, would add approximately 600 new unlicensed and uneducated dealers as to our laws and regulations in the state and approximately 20,000 mechanics. I feel that you would undermine the previously passed legislation that has been very successful in reducing consumer complaints. I feel that you will see an increase in consumer complaints if you in fact go forward with this, what you're considering. What happens in the real world as far as the way things are happening now and would continue? When vehicles are sold by unlicensed dealers, the titles are not always transferred to the buyer. That, in other words, we have people driving around cars that are registered to someone else and they may or may not be insured. if a vehicle has current tags, as this representative said before, it makes them valuable. Let's say, for instance, a car has November of 2004 tags on it, it's good to drive for a couple years, you don't really have to insure it, it makes that car more valuable, and it may or may not be operated by an unlicensed and or uninsured person. As you're probably already aware, 10% of the vehicles operated on the roads in the state of Oregon right now are uninsured. I feel that 2455 would only exacerbate this problem. This is certainly a risk to the other 90% of the people operating vehicles in the state of Oregon and doing it properly. I don't think it's your intent to undermine the state laws with 2455. The dealer education program has been very, very successful to date and continues to be so. I would hope that you feel the citizens of the state of Oregon are entitled to the current protections afforded by our laws and regulations, and that you would not see those diminished. In support of my comments, and I'd like to make a couple of comments about what the tow industry testified to earlier, the gentleman who was sitting in the chair I'm now in testified that the tow industry previously, they thought that 25% of the title and paperwork on the vehicles that they were currently towing had not been done correctly. One question I wish this committee had asked of the previous testimony is who transfers the titles to those 4,000 vehicles that Speeds Towing and Mr. Coe sell each year through the auction? The answer is not really anybody. The buyer is given lien papers and a bill of sale. It is up to that buyer to see that that vehicle is properly transferred and getting a proper title. They may or may not do that. So, especially in the event that the car has current tags. If they were licensed dealers, they would be required to see that the vehicle is, in fact, that the title is transferred. We, as licensed dealers in the state of Oregon, we see that that people we're selling cars to have current driver's license and that they do, in fact, have insurance, and we verify that. I believe it's our responsibility of all the citizens of the state of Oregon to make sure our highways are safe for everyone who operates a vehicle. And I think that this bill, 2455, would undermine that. I think that we need a stricter enforcement of our current laws. We do not need to diminish the laws we currently have. I would be happy to answer any of your questions.
Why don't we each of you give your testimony, and then we'll open the question.
My name is Bill Egan, and I'm very thankful that we live in a country that we can come and address a chair full of representatives to for which we vote. I also am a father of four children that I've raised until they're about 18 years old now, which is somewhat of a challenge still. And I now own a car lot, which I've operated for 2 years. And I'm finding that out. They didn't tell me that in the book. I'm a newbie to this industry and have been introduced to some things like you've said is not very nice. It appears as though to me that tow operators have the opportunity to go pick up cars off of the road, which they are licensed to do, and they do provide us a great service to keep our roads from being cluttered with vehicles that people decide to leave on the side of the road or for other reasons can't afford to take care of properly. My concern is here is that if we open up this to allow them to do this on a regular basis, in my business that I've been able to etch out for the last 2 years, I've lost a little bit of money, not a lot, but a little bit of money that concerns me to raise my kids. They go along and take these vehicles, and they don't inform anybody until about 2 weeks after they have them. I hold the title to the vehicle as a lien holder, and the next thing you know, the vehicle is taken away from a tow fee, $35 a day storage that you don't know about for 2.5 weeks. You got an $800 bill. They take the title away. They got the car for nothing. I got nothing. They made money. I lost. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Marlon Mitchell. I own Albany Auto Sales in Albany, Oregon. Not that it matters, but I've been in the business since 1966. And you know, we did not discuss before we came up here what we're going to talk about. A little bit of what I want to echo is what Al Hutchinson spoke about. One concern is that we pass a bill, House Bill 2455,
that has the potential to be an obsolete bill within a short amount of time, and I'll explain what I mean by that. The DMV has the who puts out the rules and regulations on title transfers, as the dealers, and regulates what we need to do. And I think part of the concern comes here with cars being driven and out on the road without proper license and registration in that person's name and or insurance in that person's name. A lot of the, especially your more inexpensive cars, they don't want to do that. We've talked about that already. Passing a bill that perhaps in a year or two or three or five may be an obsolete or have to be redone and reworded simply because the DMV now requires every dealer to require transfer a title. As present, it's not true. You don't have to. You can hand the title to the person and they're required to go do it. Quote. Many of them don't do it. But that's the law. And if we exempt... My question is, if we exempt a group, a segment of this industry that does not need to be regulated to do that, and the DMV comes along and says, okay, now we need to do that, we have no exemption of a group of business here that is doing car business, that they don't have to be involved in the title transfer process and the insurance process. Now what do? We look back and say, well, we've exempt these people by law, by bill. We exempt this process, and we're just talking about the consumer, the ultimate consumer. We're not talking about the public auction, et cetera, as Monty spoke of. We're talking about at the consumer level when you're retailing something. How are we going to protect that process? But they have a title. They have it legally transferred into their name. And perhaps insurance on it as requirements. If we exempt a segment of the industry from having to be licensed and have to do those requirements, what do we do down the road? Much as Alan said, we're, as the car dealers, licensed, we have certain requirements we need to do, and if they change those, we will have to comply. If we exempt a segment of the industry from doing that, they're not going to have to comply because they're exempt as being dealers and doing dealer work. Thank you.
And so in the process of selling a vehicle, whether it's a auto dealer selling the vehicle or a tow truck operator selling the vehicle, there's no requirement for insurance. When they sell that vehicle to that person or you sell that vehicle to that person, you're not verifying that they're covered by insurance.
There's no requirement from the DMV that it has to be done.
And then there's no requirement as far as the transfer of title?
At the dealer level?
At the dealer level?
No, there is not a requirement. There's not a requirement. This is a DMV regulation, okay? That vehicle is retailed. That person, there are a couple of requirements, but if he comes in and pays you cash money, he has the option to go do his dealer transfer process himself. He has within 30 days to do that. That's a regulation.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as every dealer is a DMV agent, and the requirements of a DMV agent are pretty strict. I think maybe Kelly Taylor should answer that question. When a dealer is submitting the documents on behalf of the consumer, now you have a completely different standard. What we have been told in private by Department of Justice and some other lawyers is we have no ability to say no to a consumer who requires us to give them the title. We cannot refuse to give them the title so that they can go transfer it. We don't have the ability to not sell that car just because we want to title it for them. We don't particularly like that rule. We don't particularly think it's a really good idea.
Correct.
Thank you. Representative,
I was going to ask this of Mr. Hutchinson. I'll ask it of Monty since he's here now. And I was going to add, I don't think Mr. Hutchinson remembers, but he and I learned how to do the chicken dance in Munich, Germany in 1981. I think it was 81, something like that. Good to 81. See you again.
Good to see you.
In 81, and you did a chicken dance?
I could still move.
I'd pay $100 for that.
That, however, is not my question.
Oh, okay.
He's a good chicken dancer, by the way. My question deals with photographs. Having spent a little time in the automobile business, the lots I see here clearly appear to be retail outlets, and as so such, I suspect that I believe they should be regulated in some kind of dealer fashion. But I also question, you know, from the tow truck operator output, I can't imagine any of these lots are collectively these lots selling 4,000 vehicles a month or 400 vehicles a month, and I would seriously doubt they sell 40 vehicles a month. So that begs the question of shouldn't there be some kind of differentiation between retail automobile sales and the tow truck operator that has a piece of junk that he's just trying to get rid of, even though they might go through that same process of acquiring title?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mabry, no. If they are sold to consumers, we don't feel that there should be any difference between on dealer licensing.
But my question was retail consumer as opposed to getting rid of a piece of junk, taking it to a disposal operation.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mabry, we do believe there is a complete difference between consumer sales and the rest of the story. We're not concerned that any tow operator or anybody else have any licensing requirements if they are selling them to wreckers, dismantlers, wholesalers, other dealers, whoever, or have sold them in the public auction process. The only objection we have to the bill is after the public auction process has finished, and now they own the car, if they sell it to on a consumer basis, which those pictures are showing you that part of it, that's the only place we're objecting to their car sales, which is, I think, by the testimony, probably, 5 or 10% of the whole story of all the cars they're selling, of the 100,000 or whatever. So only the consumer sales is our objection. Everything else, we're fine with. Sell it to whoever you want. Those are all business sales. Those aren't consumer sales.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I do. I have really a dumb question. Do you guys ever, all the people involved here, ever get in a room, sit down, open up a six-pack of beer, and talk about your troubles and try to work them out? Because
you buy
we all have different varying degrees here, and maybe a work group or something might help solve this. Is that a dumb question?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Zahner, we have been in numerous work groups, and we continue to in those work groups. I would like to say for the record, the first movement we have seen from that the other side of the story has been the record keeping, and that was 2 weeks ago, and we have been working on this for 4 years. That is the only move they have made.
Would you think a work group would help? How would you guys feel about that? I don't mean to step on your toes, Mr. Chair, but I'm trying to get this in.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Zahner, there is a work group that is working. You might not be aware there are two bills in the House Business Committee also that deal with the exact same portion of the law, and there is a work group working there at this time. On basically the same issues, and we are at the same place. It seems to me, I mean, we believe we've moved. We have invited them to meet with our board as late as yesterday afternoon. That has never happened. None of our invitations to their members have ever been accepted.
to come and meet our members. I don't know what else to do after 4 years. I kind of thinking it's pretty close to you guys got to set the policy. That's not a really good place to be, and I don't think it's a place anybody wants to be. We've moved a huge amount from what the law is to what it could be. The only place we're apart really is the consumer sale of a vehicle. Do you want it to be by a dealer, or do you want it open for 20,000 more people?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Egan, you had one more question.
I have a customer on the lot probably 4 months ago who I got to know a little bit because he stopped by quite often looking for a particular vehicle. Found out about maybe 3 weeks ago that he bought a vehicle from a repair place across town because they had a public auction, which wasn't advertised to anybody. The mechanics picked up on the vehicle, fixed it for the dollars that they needed to fix it for, sold it to this customer of mine who paid $39.95 for it for a number. Found out later on that mechanic made $1,000. I would have liked to have the option at a public auction to be able to pick up that vehicle, to pay the mechanic to fix it, to make what we have as a license to buy and sell automobiles. And it's happened to me once with the towing issue. I had a vehicle that was that I owned that I was the lien holder on. The people got it towed off of the highway because it broke down. I didn't get notified at the time of the tow, which would have been nice because I would have gladly paid the tow operator to bring it to my lot, even as though that I owned the paper on it. I didn't know about it until 3 weeks later. The next thing that happens, I get a notice for $800-some dollars, $500 to $800-some dollars, that it's going to be taken into repossessory lien. The people abandoned it because they didn't want to pay the tow fee. I'd have paid the tow fee up front if I'd have known, instead of having $35 a day for 3.5 weeks. So the people left it to the tow people. The tow people got the title for $169. It was a $3,000 rig. I don't get my money back because the people don't want to pay the balance of their note because it got towed off.
Thank you for your testimony.
I'd like to make an additional comment that as DMV, as agents of the Department of Motor Vehicles, we're all entitled to charge an administrative fee of $50 for doing all the paperwork, and I think that would go a ways, like for the tow industry in the recovery. That it would cost approximately $1,000 a year to have a dealer license. If they were doing 20 cars a year, they can charge a $50 per vehicle registration and title fee, and that would basically could recoup their $1,000. But it would do what I think is a real problem. It would significantly diminish the amount of cars that the titles are not being transferred on, and that people that don't have valid driver's licenses and people that don't have insurance wouldn't get a car titled to them.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Representative Mayberry, it's great to see you. It was 1982.
Is there anything else? I'll close the public hearing. And Janet, do we have anything else for the committee?
Very interesting.
Thank you for your patience this morning.
Thank you.
Interesting.
Hey,
much more exciting than normal.
If there's no objection, we're adjourned.